That reception reminded me of the old country boy that I am. One of my chores about daylight was to go out and milk. This morning was very, very cold, and the old cow had her gable end twisted up against the north wind. And when I reached down and got a hold, she turned around and said, "Thank you for those warm hands." So thank you, fine ladies and gentlemen, for those warm hands. Mr. Chairman, honored guests, ladies and gentlemen, and friends of Alcoholic Anonymous. First, I want to tell you that it's been a great privilege and an honor to be invited here to this wonderful meeting. I was just thinking there as I was waiting that in all my experience in AA over a good many years, I have never attended a gathering like this where I have found as much love and admiration and as many fine speakers as I have found at this conference. And I never expect to find a better one. You people are just quite wonderful. And I know that there's not a person that came here that could hear what you've heard for the last 2 days. Don't take home something that's very worthwhile to you. I know I'm going to take home a whole bucket full of it. I'll now introduce myself as I always do, and we introduce ourselves in Texas a little bit different. My name is Al, and I am definitely a recovering alcoholic. And I am a member of Alcoholic Anonymous. And by trying the best of my emotional and mental qualifications and limitations to follow the 12 suggested steps of this beautiful program to physical recovery and to spiritual growth, and by receiving an awful lot from thousands of people just like you, and by the grace of Almighty God, it hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink of beverage alcohol, bring it down to time, it'd be 25 minutes, 4 days, 11 months and 23 years. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I only speak of the length of my sobriety, not the quality. Maybe I could have done better than I have, but I'll assure you that when I found this wonderful way of life, I dedicated my life to it. And I've given every moment of that time that I could possibly spare, trying every day to do my honest best to give to someone else what someone was kind enough to give to me. I also feel that I should state to you humbly that I don't feel that I hold any special position of leadership in this beautiful fellowship on account of the length of my sobriety or my experience. I am simply a member of Alcoholic Anonymous, feeling that I can shake hands with and say brother or sister to the vilest drunken man or woman that ever lived. If anything should come to your moral admonition through what I say, it comes not from a sense of moral superiority, it comes from the depths of my heart and my experience. And I'm hoping and praying this afternoon that I will be able to say something that might be helpful to someone here. That is my mission in life. And to do that, I'm not going off on a drunkalog. I don't ever do that. Used to a long time ago. But I'd much rather qualify myself as an alcoholic and then talk about the wonderful program that has kept me alive over these years. I realize that I am in the evening of my life, because I am in my 82nd year. Thank God. And I also realize that my youth has been spent, that my get up and go has got up and went. But you know, I can look at all of it with a great big smile, look at the fine people like you that I have met, and the wonderful places that my get up has been. So, you know, when we get up to talk about ourselves, we've got to use I. This is not an I program, it is a we program. But it's necessary for us to refer to I, to get a point over. And when I refer to I feel like the old boy that was confiding in his friend. He said, "George, you know I got married." He said, "That's fine, Jim." "Well, it's not so good either, George," says. "You know, my mother-in-law's come to live with us." "Well," he said, "that's bad, Jim." "Well," he said, "George, it's not so bad either, because," said, "you know, she's got quite a bit of money, and she's done bought us a house." "Well," he said, "that's good, Jim." "No, Jim, George, it's not so good either, because, you know," said, "she's going to live there with us." "Well," he said, "that's bad, Jim." "Well, it's not so bad either," said. "You know that house burned down last night?" He said, "Well, that is bad, Jim." "No, George, it wasn't so bad, because," said, "she burned up in it." So, I'm an old country boy, as I said before, and they call me from Texas. That's where I'm from. But I've got some news for you. I am a native son of California. And I was born right out here at Pomona. My family moved back to Texas after I was 2 years old, and I've lived in that state most of the time since. However, I did manage a hotel in the Hollywood Plaza in Hollywood for 1 year for Mr. Hilton, because I drank it and break myself out of all the jobs in Texas. I come out here, stayed with me a year with him, and he's going to teach me how to drink. Well, he didn't teach me how to drink. I did teach him how to play golf, because I used to be quite a golf player. And I went back to Texas, and I continued to drink. You know, I was 26 years old before I ever touched liquor. When I ran away from home, I came to Fort Worth, which is about 40 miles away, and I got me a job washing dishes in a hotel. And I worked awful hard. I didn't know anything else but hard work, because there's a big family of us, and we had to work to make a living. But I didn't like that farming business. So I rose up pretty fast in the hotel business. I finally got out in the front office, you know, and had a wonderful memory, you know. I could remember a man's name, but I didn't see him once a year and call him by it. Remember the room he was in and all that. It was the talk of the country about my memory. Still the talk of country now that I can't remember nothing anymore. It's quite embarrassing, too, at times. You get with a big crowd, you know, and some old boy will run up, "Hello, Al, how are you? I'm so glad to see you." And I come right back at him, "Well, I'm sure so glad to see you, too." But every once in a while, they find a smart aleck. And he'll say, "Now, old Al makes out like he knows me. He don't know where I'm from or what my name is." And I say, "You're just right as you can be. I'm like the old boy went to the doctor and said, 'Doctor, I've got an awful problem.'" He said, "What's your problem, George?" He said, "Don't remember a thing I did last month." I said, you don't? I said, how old are you? He said, 65. Why, he said, heck, Doc, said, you haven't got no, George, you haven't got no problems. Said, everybody gets that way when they get that old. Oh, you don't know what a problem this is. Don't know what I did last week. I said, just forget about it. Just forget all about it. I said, I can't forget this problem, Doc, because I don't know what I did last night. The doctor kind of got a little interested. You don't remember anything you did last night? He said, no, I don't. He said, how long you had that problem? He said, what problem you talking about? See, so... But I got very interested in the food end of the business, and I went in dining car service, worked up as superintendent of service on a big line. Then I took over country clubs, three of them, one in Fort Worth and two in Dallas. And you know, when you manage a country club, you're a servant to as many members as you have. One of Texas' wealthiest women that was raised in the same little town that I was raised in Decatur, Texas. Of course, she was sent away to fine school. I didn't know her too well, but I knew the two boys. They were good friends of mine. Had purchased a family hotel in Dallas, the only hotel in Dallas. So she hired me to run that hotel for her. Well, she decided she wanted to move to Dallas, and so she had me buy the finest home I could find. And I had put away two big truckloads of liquor during the old days before the country went dry. Stored it in her father's basement in Fort Worth. And when she got over to Dallas, of course, being the personality that she was, Dallas high society flocked around her. And I had that by government order transferred, that liquor transferred over to her home. And it was all good whiskey, and back in those days, you couldn't buy no good whiskey. Man, I'm telling you right now, there's a drunken brawl out at her house all the time. And it come my duty to help take care of them. I had a special crew that she'd have maybe 15 or 20 couples I'd go out and feed them. And they were Dallas High Society that had been members of country clubs, and they still treated me as a servant. Ordered me around, you know, and I didn't like that at all. I was a big hotel man, and I didn't like it a bit. Sometime I would be out there for 18 hours without a wink of sleep, taking care of drunks, undressing them, putting them to bed. One night about 11 o'clock, she walked into this beautiful bar, and I was hanging on to it. I hadn't slept in about 18 hours, and she came up to me, and she said, Al, honey, I want you to take this drink. I said, Lecter, I never drink. She said, I know that you don't, but then I want you to take it because you haven't had any rest and said it'll be helpful to you. Just go on and take it down. She was about half drunk herself. Bless her heart, she died an alcoholic many years later. Well, I just satisfied, I turned it up and drank it down, and it gagged me. I stood there for a few minutes, and I turned to the bartender, colored bartender, and I said, Walter, what was that she gave me? He said, that's a Scotch highball. I said, fix me another one just like it. So he fixed another one for me, and I just turned it up and drank it down. He said, Mr. Badger, you're not supposed to drink it like that. You're supposed to sip it. I said, heck, I can't stand the taste of the darn stuff. And you know of all the whiskey that I have drunk in my life, and that's a lot of it, I never could stand the taste of alcohol. Beer and wine, anything else. I always took it like I'd take a dose of medicine. Mixed drinks was out for me. In about 5 minutes, I walked out into this big parlor where the drunks was laying all over the floor, and this little old guy in there, he never saw me. He didn't holler at me and bring him another drink or do something for him. And he yelled out, Al, where have you been? Said, go and get me a drink. I haven't seen you in the last 10 or 15 minutes. Said, get it right away. Man, I said, get up, you SB, and get your own damn drink. I said, I'm not a servant to nobody. No anybody in this room. Well, that just pleased the life out of a lot of those people. They just died laughing about it. And it wasn't no time till I was telling them stories that I'd come from across the track that they'd never heard of. And I made myself very popular with all that bunch. but I was never treated as a servant by them anymore or anybody else. Now, you know, I used those two drinks as a glass crutch for many years. I never thought about taking more than two. If I had a situation to meet, I'd take my two drinks and I'd go out and meet that situation. It gave me courage, it opened my mouth and loosened up my tongue. I wasn't educated, I was bashful, but boy, those two drinks would just fix it right. In fact, I just didn't know how I lived without it, how I got where I did without those two drinks. But of course, as the years went by, I had got to taking a little more. And finally, I hauled off and got drunk. Well, the next morning, I felt terrible, and I said, I ain't going to ever do that no more. And I didn't for a long time. Didn't even take my two drinks. But it took a long time for me to pass over that line. More and more to get where I wanted to be. But when I passed over that invisible line from what we term social drinking to pathological drinking, ladies and gentlemen, I lost one of the greatest gifts that God gave you and I. Because I lost my self-respect, I lost my fixed loyalty to my fine little family, wife and son, and to the people I worked for. I carried a terrible sense of guilt of what is happening to me. Then I began to build up alibis and excuses for my drinking, and it lasted much longer than it should have. And due to my capacity to misrepresent with certain skill, I won the admiration of the charter members of the biggest liars club in the nation. I told them so big I believed in myself. It would be needless for me to go into the story of the heartbreak and sorrow that this caused, the pain of hangover, lapse of memory. Mental deterioration had set in. When I go back in my past, ladies and gentlemen, I'm not proud of it. I look upon my past with regret. Today I'm seeking to atone for some of my misdeeds, to right some of my wrongs, to wipe away many tears that I caused. And I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I gave it everything that I had. Because I traveled down that one street a long way, all the way to the end. I had a chain of hotels that I'd worked hard to build up. I drank them up. Then I drank up a lot of big jobs. I had 34 hotels over 14 states that I was general manager of. The old man that owned those hotels fired me three times and looked me up and hired me back with a promise I'd never take another drink. He offered me a big bonus the last time. I never made a bonus, but I did make 9 months. And the bonus was $2,500, which is a lot of money back in those days. One of his big men that owned a big insurance company there, he did, and this man run it for him. He came up to Austin, Texas, where I had headquarters. One afternoon he sent for him to come up to his suite of room. And I went up, he had some men he wanted me to meet. And he said, "Al, sir, I was with Mr. Moody yesterday." And he said, "He's so glad to have you back with him." He said, "You know what he told me? He'd rather have you running his hotels drunk and a lot of people run them sober." I said, "You don't mean to tell me Mr. Moody said that, did he?" He said, "He certainly did." I said, "Bernie, just pour me a drink." And bang went the $2,500 bonus. I know all about what any of you out there, alcoholics, suffered, because I think I've done everything that anyone else did. I could build up in my imagination and produce some of the darndest things of any man that ever was, I think. I was an expensive drunk. You give me a few drinks, and boy, I'm telling you right now, I got out and threw my money around. When I came back from California to Texas, I went to one of our biggest bankers, who was a personal friend of mine, and I said, Nate, I said, you know, I can buy that golden pheasant if I had any money. The man wants to sell it and told me he'd sell it to me right. But I haven't got no money, and I know it's not a bankable loan. He said, well, that's a little gold mine. That was one of the finest eating places between San Francisco and New Orleans, had that record. He said, Bad said, what have you done about your drinking? I said, I quit that. I don't drink anymore. And I had for 2 weeks. He said, if you quit that drinking, said, I'll buy that restaurant for you. And I don't want you to pay it out and give me a half interest. It all belongs to you whenever you do. If you quit that drinking, ain't nothing in the world wrong with you but that. And I'll just be happy to buy it. And he did. $25,000 for that fine little restaurant. I stayed sober. I paid it out a little over a year. Then I set about drinking it up. After I got him paid off, I figured, now, if I want to drink this whiskey, that's my business. I got a fine bank account. And then I'm just going to start drinking again. And I won't tell you right now that I come down here drinking that gold mine up. But the war come on, I got to making so much money I couldn't drink it all up and like to kill me. I shall never forget the last drunk. I'd been gone for 2 weeks on this drunk. And my poor little wife didn't know where in the world I was. It's a funny thing, a strange quirk about the alcoholic, and we've all got it. You take yourself back. You spend money you didn't have for whiskey you didn't need, always trying to impress somebody you didn't like. That's characteristic with us. And another characteristic we've got, we always try to hurt the thing that we love most. Stumbled into my apartment about 2:30 in the morning, fell in bed with a drunken stupor. I rolled and I tumbled, shaking from head to foot. And I heard my little wife open her bed, snubbing away and saying, not this time, God, but maybe next time. Well, that just cut me to the heart. Next morning, I finally got to sleep. The next morning, she'd gone to take care of my business for me. So I worked everything all out. I had a nice bank account. I brought my son back in to help me run the business. He had a big job with the Humble Oil Company, but I brought him in because I trained him in that field while he was getting his education. Had a fine business and a lot of insurance, and that my wife and son would be a lot better off without me. Leading up to this, there was a little woman that brought Alcoholic Anonymous to Dallas, Texas. Esther. What a great woman she was. She's gone now. After struggling for a year to get it started there, and she had about 20 members, she permitted a story to be printed in the Dallas Morning News, a feature story wrote by one of the greatest feature writers that we've ever known. And what a beautiful story he wrote about the history of her life. And the heading of that story is the story of a drunkard. She told everything that happened to her. My wife read that story, and she saw me in that story, in that everything that she did, I did. So she called this lady up. She said, darling, now let me tell you something about an alcoholic you probably don't know. Don't go and get that paper and say, read this. Go and get you several papers and put one on his desk. Put one on his night table and don't say a word about it. That she did. And I tore up many of them to him in the wastebasket because I didn't refer to me. I wasn't no drunkard. Boy, at that time, I was proudly boasting of my personal liberties and the right to drink when I wanted to. I didn't know what personal liberty was. I took one drink, and then I was a slave to John Barleycorn, the greatest despot of the ages. Thank God today my personal liberty is the right not to drink and to enjoy life in a great, wide, wonderful world. I decided that the best thing for me to do would be to jump from that seven-story window. I went over and opened the screen, pushed up the window, and I thought I'd better start thinking things over a little bit, but when I said, "Ain't no use me thinking about it, the best thing for me to do," and I got up to start the window, I fell and I grabbed the night table, and my hand was right on that paper. I said, "Well, the last thing I can do, and I know she's been wanting me to read this, I'm going to read this thing." And in that story, I found the history of my own life. At the end of that story, it said, "If anyone is suffering like I suffered like this and wants to do something about it, to call this number." I called it. 10 minutes, two nice-looking men walked in my room, well-dressed, they smelled good, and I didn't. Happy as they could be, smiled on their faces. One old boy looked at me and he said, "You're pretty drunk, aren't you?" I know, he said, "You're pretty sick, aren't you?" And I said, "I'm not sick." I said, "I'm just a no-good drunk." He said, "Where you got your whiskey head?" I said, there's a full pint between the mattress and springs. I said, "What do you want to do with that?" He'd already got it out. He said, "I'm going to give you a drink." I said, "Listen, I didn't invite you gentlemen down here to teach me how to drink. I know how to do that. I'll take that drink and I'll be drunk again. I'm trying to get sober." With that, he had poured already, said, "Drink this down." Said, "You're shaking so damn bad." Said, "We think you're waving at us and that we want to talk to you." Their cheerfulness and goodwill created an atmosphere of sympathy. They told me their stories, which encouraged me to tell them mine. They more or less ran a transmission belt from their lives to mine, and I no longer felt alone. I went to my first meeting with those two men and their wives. Man, I thought I'd really got myself into something, sure enough. The place is a Skid Row part of town upstairs. There's a liquor store on one side of the stairway and a beer joint on the other, and we stumbled over two drunks going up to the meeting room. And I never heard as much laughter in my life and hollering and going on. And I thought, "Boy, you're going to the biggest drunken party you've ever been in, see?" An old boy standing at the door, and I walked up. He said, "What's your first name?" I said, "Al." He yelled out, "Got a new member, old Al's here." Man, they come running around me and slapping me on the back, and everybody talking at once, and nobody listening. You know, I thought, man alive, these people are really drunk. Finally, old boy said, "You'd like to have a drink?" I said, "Heck yes." I'd had two big ones before I left the restaurant, only 5 or 6 blocks away. And went over in the corner, and there was an old makeshift counter built out of a piece of sheetrock and a 2-gallon pot on a hot plate. I said, "Now, you want some of this good coffee or Coca-Cola?" I said, "Hell, don't want either one, or want some whiskey." Well, he said, "We haven't got no whiskey, it's time to start the meeting." He said, "Come up and sit with me." He got me around the front row. An old boy got up there, and he said, "We're conducting the meeting tonight on the spiritual side of Alcoholic Anonymous." Well, that kind of got me, because, you know, I didn't even believe there was a God. I was raised in a Christian family, but I left all that at home and I ran away. I was an atheist or an agnostic, I think both. Well, everything he said, God did it for him, you know. And then I got to thinking, well, hell, I'm mixed up here with a bunch of holy rollers, religious fanatics. And I like to twist the bottom of that chair out of his old wind. Boy, I got out of there. Everybody that talked, God did this and he did that. Well, you know, back in those days, they didn't know much about this thing. Everybody was so happy, you know, they were just talking at random. Well, I went back to my restaurant, what few was in there, got him out. I locked that door and went back and got me a quart of cold champagne and stood on a little step tee there and cried in that bottle and passed myself out, bemeaning myself for getting mixed up with a bunch of religious fanatics or holy rollers. How sick can a drunken alcoholic's mind be? The next morning when my wife came, I didn't get home. Of course, she was disappointed. She said, "What's happened?" I said, "Well, honey," I said, "you know, I've got all thought out. We're going to sell out the restaurant and we'll leave town." She said, "What for?" I said, "That place I went to last night, I got mixed up with a bunch of holy rollers all over Dallas and be talked of, and I said, we'd just be ruined." "Oh," she said, "I think you must be wrong about that." But I said, "You know, I did hear that my friend over in Fort Worth, vice president of the Gulf Oil Corporation, no drunken playmate of mine, was in this thing." She said, "Well, that sorry thing couldn't be messed up with this." But I said, "I'm going to call him anyhow." One of the smartest things I ever did in my life. When Mac got on the phone and I said, "Mac, I understand that you haven't had a drink in a year." He said, "Where'd you hear that?" I said, I went down to a meeting of holy rollers and all. I thought you had too much sense to get mixed up with that." He said, "Are you having some trouble, Al?" I said, "Yeah, I'm about half drunk now." "You be there as quick as I can get there." Hung up in my ear. I thought, that's kind of funny. Another old boy, the Gulf Boys, one of the richest men in Texas, another one of my old drunken playmates. There's about three of us, we'd get together pretty often. I always run around a lot of drunk, around a lot of rich people. I always thought I was going to get something out of it, you know. But I never made a dime out of all the multimillionaires that I worked for, and I always worked for rich ones. Well, anyhow, they came over. I took them around kind of in the back. They had dinner all fixed for them late in the evening. And they went to talking. They're all sober. That surprised me. I thought they were all drunk. Come on, get me all drunk with them. My wife didn't like it a bit, you know. She thought that wasn't going to happen. Finally, you know, they just been telling stories about some old things that happened to us. I got kind of shaken. I said, "Let me run and get you some hot bread." "Oh," I said, "get the waiter. He's right there." I said, "Oh, I'll get us right back through that door." And I dive through that door and down that wine cellar and grab that jug and take two or three big licks at it. And then I'd back and give him the bread. And about the third trip, the old boy said, "Now, next time you go down that wine cellar, get that jug and bring it up here and put it on the table. You won't have to make so many trips." You know, I thought I was getting by with that. But anyhow, those boys took me to Fort Worth, and there they got me sober on what we had back in those days, the Kansas City treatment. Now, boy, that's some treatment, but it'll darn sure get you sober. I used, every once in a while, 2 ounces of whiskey and 4 ounces of water. You got to sit there with that bird, though, you're giving it to, because he don't get it only every 3 hours, and it's bottled right up where you can see it. They got it, they had the bridal suite. First time I ever been in a hotel all my life, and the first time I ever seen a king-size bed. Had a canopy over it and all that business. They sit there with me for 36 hours, and the last drink I took was at 1 o'clock, 5th of July, 1945, and I was as sober as I am right now. Then the work began. I began to come to meetings in Fort Worth. Then I finally went to go to meetings. And I told them all how I was going to work this program. I didn't want any of this God stuff. That first step, I believed every word of that. Then I want to jump up there at that 12th step, and I was going to get out and sober up and meet a lot of drunks. And I went day and night for 2 months, and my fine sponsor just stood by and watched me. One night I drove over in a storm. I said, "Mac, I'm not coming back no more." He said, "What's the matter, Al?" I said, "I haven't had a decent night's sleep in 2 months. I'm up all night long when he's drunk, trying to sober up. I haven't sobered up nobody." He looked at me with that little dry grin. I can see it now. And he said, "Well, Al," said, "why don't you try joining Alcoholic Anonymous?" Well, I said, "What the heck do you think I've been doing? I come over here every Wednesday night, and I go to 2 meetings in Dallas tonight." He said, "I know," but says, "you haven't got but 1.5 steps," and said, "it's a 12-step program." Well, I said, "Mac, what must I do?" He ran his hand in his pocket and pulled out a little piece of paper there, and the second and third step was wrote in his handwriting, and I still have it in my file. He said, "Now, this is a suggestion only. Take this home with you. Don't go to your apartment. Go back to your place of business and open the door and go in where you go all alone. And see Al if you can't in some way accept your second and third step tonight. Don't do this unless you want to. I said, Mac, you never told me wrong yet. I'll do it. So I did. At 2:30 in the morning, I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I questioned it, of course, because I was a smart boy. Money in the bank, big businessman, well respected by some and hated by others, which was a normal situation. But I finally accepted that step when it came to the third step, willing to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood in my book. I said, that I can't do, I just don't believe it. Here's where the miracle came. There's a little wee voice that came to me just as plain as I'm talking to you now. I even turned around to see if someone was talking. Said, if you don't believe in me, you do believe in your sponsor. Let him be your higher power until you can find me. Well, I went to shaking all over. I wonder where that come from. But then that is a good thing to do anyhow, wherever it come from. That I'll do. I never said a word about that to nobody till next Wednesday night, and I went back to Fort Worth, and he was at the door to greet me with it, put his arm around me and pulled me over to one side. He said, Al, I'm glad to have you back. I knew you'd be here. And let me tell you something, my friend. I'll do my very best to act as your higher power and you find the God that I have. I looked at him kind of funny. I said, what do you mean by that, Mac? He said, at 2:30 in the morning after you left here, I was awake and thinking about you, and it came to me very plainly that you had selected me as your higher power. Well, I said, Mac, that's exactly what happened. I told him what happened. I said, how can a thing like that happen? He said, you'll realize, Al, if you can get onto this step, go to living by it, that God does things in strange ways. I said, what must I do now? He handed me three little contracts, only four or five words in them. I said, it seemed way back from the old timers have, that we used for our morning contract. He said, memorize the one you like best and walk to your mirror. And as you look at yourself, repeat it. The third morning, I threw them on the bathroom floor, and I looked in the mirror, and I said, God, if you exist, and I just can't believe you do, but if you do exist, I'm going to ask you to give me a morning contract that I'll promise you I'll say every morning the longest day that I live. To my great surprise, I said, good morning, God, this is another day. It's a brand new day from your hand. I'm not going to ask you to do anything for me today I can do myself. But I know there's many things coming up this day where I'm going to need your help and guidance. And God, don't forget to send someone to me today to suffering like I was and give me the proper words and I might show that person a happy life. I was shaking from head to foot and all day long I tried to put that together and it just didn't work at all. The next morning I approached that mirror in fear. Those same words came out. And they have come out every morning. Never do I miss that. This morning, the same thing. When I told Mac about what I'd done, he said, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Now, Al, I want you to find out a little bit more about yourself. He said, take your tenth step. And he says, it tells you to continue to take your personal inventory of yourself. And when you're wrong, promptly admit it. I said, I'll do just that. So don't do it unless you want to. I said, how often do you want me to do it? Often as you want to. So I conceived the idea the best time to do that would be at night, before I went to sleep. I'm closing a day I'll never be able to live again. Why not look that day over? So I started out with my inventory. And note, it wasn't any time that was too natural things for me to do. Contract with Almighty God in the morning and an inventory at night where I reconstruct my whole day, and you know it gets very interesting. I've never had anything like a perfect day. Many mornings I've got to get up now, walk down and apologize to some bellboy or some waitress, some sharp remark I always do. I'll tell you one thing that'll do for you. It'll teach you everything about yourself. I know all about me, and there's a whole lot about me I don't like. And I'm trying to change it, too. But that's two things that I do in Alcoholic Anonymous. On July the 5th, 1945, ladies and gentlemen, I inherited a great fortune from a man that I have no regret at his passing. Under the condition of this inheritance, I feel that I should share it with others. And I find it's a big cut for everyone. Because it's not the kind of a fortune that's affected by bank failures, stock market crashes, or business depressions. It has withstood all such things. The man who bequeathed riches to me looked exactly like I do outwardly. The same name, the same parents, the same childhood, the same early manhood. In fact, he was my former self. My former self laid down and died. And the autopsy showed that he died from pessimism, fear, hate, resentment, vain regrets, and many, many other complications. But old Al wasn't wholly bad. He left me with a great store of courage. He gave me a lot of things that I could work with. And I use these things. But there's one strange thing about this wonderful gift, this fortune that's been given to me, that every day I give it away and I have more than I gave. As I stand before you this evening, I have more than I've ever had. Thank God. There's one thing that I want to leave with you good folks. Maybe you haven't thought much about it. But you know I owe so much. Each and every one of us in this room that has found this beautiful life, we've got a debt to repay to get the real, real good out of Alcoholic Anonymous. And God in His wisdom selected you and I as surveyors of His goodness. He went not to the proud, the mighty, the famous, or the brilliant. He went to the lowly drunkard, the despised alcoholic. Well might He have said to us, under your weak and feeble hands I am entrusting a power beyond estimate, a power that has been denied the most learned of my fellows, not to scientists or statesmen, not to wives or mothers, not even to my priests and ministers have I given the gift of healing other alcoholics that I've entrusted to you. You and I must use this gift unselfishly because it carries with it grave responsibilities. No day can be too long. No time upon our hands can be too urgent. No case too pitiful. Let's remember that we have a big job to do. And you know, the only way that we can help the alcoholic is to understand the alcoholic. And to find the real meaning of it, I have found that real meaning. When I look into the suffering alcoholic with all his sorrows, knowing that each one fights a hard fight against heavy odds, when no voice of distress reaches my ear in vain, when no hand clasp seeks mine without response, when I can look into the face of the most forlorn alcoholic and see something beyond sin, when I can find good in every faith that helps our good men and women lay hold of divine things that make majestic meaning in life, regardless of what the name of that faith might be, when I know how to pray, how to love, and above all, how to hope, when I'm at peace with myself and my fellow man and with my God, when I'm awfully glad that I'm living and not too afraid to die, then, my dear friends, I've found the real combination of the AA fogle. The other alcoholics are as lonesome, as vile, and as sinful as I was, and are almost surely to be as deserving. Ladies and gentlemen, I think the highest dignity and the greatest nobility on earth for you and I to earn is a simple but entitled simple, but the title of a good AA. And when we can get to that point, the light begins to shine. And when we take alcohol out of the alcoholic's life and give him nothing in its stead, we have done a cruel act. As the alcoholic bent down with his worries, his fears, his doubts, his resentments, his state of frustration, his state of futility, there he stands alone with his loneliness, alone with his remorse, alone with his thirst. He's a stranger in a strange cold land. But that, my dear friends, thank God, whenever he comes into AA, he receives that great gift of understanding. He receives a great warm cloak of AA fellowship. He receives a refreshing meat and drink of AA friendship to refresh his spirit. He is the prodigal son come home. But this is not a one-day welcome. He's given the 12 steps by which the alcoholic slave can renounce his freedom, so that he again may be free with a freedom he never knew before. And there's the saving sanity of the 24-hour program, always living in the present. The only point at which time and eternity meets for each one of us is today. Yesterday is gone. Tomorrow hasn't come. So let's remember, there is so much good that we can do if we don't keep on guard. Reach out and find that struggling alcoholic that's still in trouble. You know, I didn't know how to pray. And my friend Matt kept telling me to pray. I remember some of the early part of my prayer, and I think it's in Grapevine. I prayed that I might have the admiration of men and women. I was given an alcoholic weakness, I might feel the need of God. I prayed for riches that I might be helpful and happy. I was given poverty that I could be humble and wise. I prayed for all of these things that I might enjoy life. Was given nothing but my sobriety so that I might enjoy all things. So I'm not going to risk spoiling with my own puny phrases the classical lines of God's strange answer to prayer. I think maybe I might be running over a little bit. No, I'm not running out of time yet. Got a few more things I want to say. You know, I find every once in a while I discover this. But before I tell you this, before I made progress, real progress in Alcoholics Anonymous, I did one thing that we never preach anymore. And back early in the day, I preached it all the time, but it took me 5 years to find a person that I could take my fifth step with. He's a minister up in Rome, Georgia, and I drove all the way up there and spent the night in his parsonage, and we sat till 2 o'clock in the morning. He was a member of AA. We'd been on programs together. And I took my first fifth step. And every once in a while I'd say, Brother Sam, I'm telling you, all these things, what in the world are you going to think about it? He said, my friend, you haven't told me once the bad things that I did. He said, you just keep on talking. That's one of the great experiences I've ever had. That opened up a new way for me. I felt free. I had taken into confidence a man I knew that wouldn't betray that confidence. And you should be careful when you're selecting someone to take the fifth step with. But if you do that, it'll be a big relief to you. A big relief. In my own little private hall of fame, Alcoholic Anonymous occupies a pedestal that no other institution has ever or will ever share. And each day I pray to Almighty God that he will keep my pride within due bounds, because he and he alone knows of my sincere inclinations. And take this home with you. I heard this at the big convention of second, I think we'd had it the next every 5 years in St. Louis. good friend of mine, we decided we'd go out to the clubhouse one afternoon. I'd been out, but he hadn't. So we got a taxi cab, and we talked to A all the way out. We went in and paid our respects and kept the cab, and when we went back and got in the cab driver handed me a program. And he said, "You know, gentlemen," said, "I drive a cab, but," said, "I'm deacon in my church, and I'm a very spiritual man, and I couldn't help from overhearing your conversation." And said, "I write a little poetry." He said, "I think this is very apropos to your program. And this is something that you can take home with you." He said, "I wish I had a telescope to scan the starry skies. But since I have no telescope, thank God for two good eyes. I wish I had a house that was run by push-button command. But while that house is still a dream, thank God for two good hands. I wish I had a supercar to give my friends a treat. But until that car comes along, thank God for two good feet. I have two eyes to look to God above. I have two hands to clasp in prayer. I have two feet to take me to AA. Thank God I'm a millionaire." That's so true with all of us. It's been so wonderful for me to come out here. I don't know, with all of my experience in AA, and I've been many, many places, but I have never, and I can say this in all honesty, met as many fine people where I find as much love and adulation as I find in this group. This is one of the highlights of my experiences, and I'm so grateful to Maury for inviting me out. And I'm never going to miss another one as long as I live and able to get here. I don't know how long that's going to be. Of course, my grandfather lived to be a ripe old age, but he drank himself to death at 102 years old. That's just as true as I'm standing here. He died at 102, and I'd take a good bottle of whiskey, sneak it in the room and hide it because he said there's putting water in his whiskey, and he didn't like that whiskey. I just haven't got the words to express my feelings toward all of you. I just hope and pray that God will keep me here long and let me keep on trying to do the things He wants me to do, and I believe He will. Just look in my car before I come out here. I'm chairman of our state alcoholic commission, something I organized 19 years ago in Texas, a state agency. I'm still chairman of it. Been appointed by all three governors. We've got a big program going. 10 state hospitals with separate wards for alcoholics and a member of Alcoholic Anonymous to be with the patients at all times. 19 big groups in our Pinal Colony with about 3,500 members of AA. I started 18 years ago with 7 men. We've got them on all the farms now, you know, doing a tremendous job. So I wasn't satisfied with the old boys coming around, you know, getting in this poor little office of mine, and you, that's one thing. Just had this little office room for two other people to sit early in AA, and it's heart-rending. You know, our work is not always pleasant. Where you look into a broken family, where you find broken hearts, rift between relatives, nagging of bitter tongues, squabbles over money and morals, see our good women growing old before their time. See little children turning away in disillusionment from the trickery of a once trusted parent. A drinking parent scourged by the selfishness of his alcoholic nature. When we see all of those things, and I've had this happen to me so often, an adult, man or woman, come in my little office and sit down in a chair and break down and cry bitter tears. That's the saddest thing that I could ever wish. Many times I'd have to walk away till they kind of got themselves together. You've heard babies wail at night. You've heard mothers mourn for loved ones. You have heard dying men groan with pain. But ladies and gentlemen, there's nothing more pitifully hopeless than the cry of the drunkard in his alcoholic misery. Babies can be fed. Time dries the tears of weeping mothers. Death relieves the pain of the dying, but the alcoholic has no refreshment in food, no solace in time, no promise in death. I'm closing with this, that your sobriety and my sobriety is a necessary state of wholesome living. Drunkenness is death. It's death to all the beautiful things, the lovely ways, the pleasant places to which our spirit cleaves. Drunkenness wrecks our work. Work is the breath of our nostrils. It wrecks our homes, and our homes is our heart's blood. It wrecks in youth maturity, strewing the country with our family's hope, its future, its way of life. And what alcohol has imposed upon you and I, AA has disposed. By following this beautiful program, you and I are persuaded to righteousness. And persuasion will not function in the face of resentment, selfishness, and hate, but thrives in an atmosphere of sympathy, understanding, and unselfishness. Sobriety like peace is an ideal. And we will achieve that ideal only through the realization of an ideal. Never should we forget we believe so easily that which we hope for earnestly. Maura used this last night, and I use it in all of my closings. And I apply it to myself, and I hope you can apply it to yourselves as you go on your homeward journey. Because I can truthfully tell you humbly that I have abandoned myself to God as I understand God. I admit my faults to Him and to my fellows. I've done my very best to clear away the wreckage of my past and to give freely of what I have found. And I'm sure that many of us will meet each other in the fellowship of the Spirit as we travel down this old happy road to destiny. May God bless and keep each and every one of you here, and I hope to meet you again.